This educational video is designed to inform the viewer of how the heart is situated within the human body, and therefore provide insights as to attitudinally correct thoracic anatomy. Attitudinally correct cardiac anatomy is a relatively new emphasis area developed via consensus by contemporary leaders in the fields of cardiac anatomy and morphology. It is designed to optimize the descriptive nomenclature of cardiac structures in relation to the three anatomical planes of the body, the sagittal, coronal, and transverse. Traditionally, the anatomical features of the heart have been described as though the heart had been removed from the body and held in front of the observer, with the right chambers to the patient's right and the apex positioned toward the ground. Unfortunately, this particular practice led to the cardiac features being described as right or left, when actually anterior and posterior. This consequently caused unnecessary confusion in communications between clinicians, scientists, radiologists, and other specialists, all whom utilize their own spatial perspectives. Today, the importance of understanding the positioning of the heart in the body has increased dramatically as cardiac imaging provides high-definition images of the heart functioning in vivo. This video will guide the viewer through the anatomy within the thoracic cavity, starting from the extracorporeal view and subsequently through various planes of dissection while defining the major anatomical landmarks applicable to the fields of cardiac imaging and cardiac surgery. All orientations will be defined in relation to the viewed human body, e.g. right, left, anterior, posterior, inferior, or superior. One first observes the thoracic portion of a male cadaver draped to clinically represent the presentation of the thorax as if to perform a full sternotomy. The anatomical tutorial first indicates the relative underlying location of both the xiphoid process and sternum by tracing the positions of these structures from posterior to superior. From the sternal notch, we can see the medial edge of the left clavicle, or collarbone, which extends laterally reaching up to the shoulder. And this bone is mirrored on the right, with the right clavicle being traced from the right shoulder, lateral, to the sternum, medial. The base of the ribcage generally defines the transition between the pleural cavity and the abdomen, traced from this subject's left to right. This border is further defined by the diaphragm, the muscular structure that helps expand the pleural cavity upon inhalation, thus inflating the lungs. In this demonstration, care was taken when accessing the thoracic cavity to ensure that the diaphragm, and consequently abdomen, was not breached. As can be observed here, in the center of the ribcage, the xiphoid process protrudes posteriorly from the bottom of the sternum. This cartilaginous structure is often used as a reference point for the positioning of ultrasound probes. Transthoracic echocardiography is the most common method currently being employed to obtain cardiac images. It is non-invasive and can typically be easily performed on any cooperative patient. Only rarely do such procedures require sedation or anesthesia. Yet, the imaging procedure can be limited by patient size and/or by interference from soft tissues, bones, or the lungs. A standardized transthoracic echocardiogram is commonly performed by imaging from four anatomic windows on the chest, as shown by the following slides. It should be noted that this may typically require the use of multiple transducers at varied ultrasound frequencies to maximize the two-dimensional image resolution and/or the obtained Doppler ultrasound information. Parasternal echo views are used to obtain long axis images of the left side of the heart, including the left atrium, ventricle, and the aorta. A subtle tilt of the transducer inferiorly from this position gives views of the right atrium, tricuspid valve, and right ventricle, and tilting leftward brings the pulmonary valve and main pulmonary artery into view. Turning the transducer and scan plane by 90 degrees results in short axis views of the heart in planes from the base of the heart to the apex. Apical windows are typically employed to reveal standard four-chamber echo views of the right and the left atrium ventricles and the mitral and tricuspid valves. This transducer position sends the ultrasound beam parallel to the septal structures. Thus, it is considered not adequate to assess the integrity of either the atrial or ventricular septum. However, tilting the transducer anteriorly results in a five-chamber view that allows excellent visualization of the left ventricular outflow tract and the aorta. Additionally, Doppler gradients across the valves can readily be obtained from such views. Subcostal echo views are particularly useful in patients with lung disease or in those who have had recent open heart surgery. From such obtained subcostal images, the orientation of the heart in the chest and the major vascular connections can be well visualized. Subcostal views also allow for excellent characterizations of the atrial septum and for four-chamber echo views in patients with poor apical windows. Suprasternal notch echo views are most useful for visualization of the aortic arch, its branching vessels, and the descending thoracic aorta. They are also useful for determining the Doppler shifts across the aortic valve. These views are important for use in patients in whom one wants to assess vascular abnormalities, for example, coarctation of the aorta. Over the next series of slides, we will dissect down toward the heart by freeing up and reflecting back the skin, the muscular layers, and finally removing the ribcage. Once the skin has been reflected back, the pectoral muscles and bones of the ribcage can be seen.
The sternum is highlighted and traced in a superior direction from the xiphoid process toward the sternal notch.
The pectoralis major muscles are now defined. In this slide, the right pectoralis major is outlined. And here, the left pectoralis major.
By separating the pectoralis major muscles from the interior structures, one can better visualize the origin of the muscles at the sternum and insertion points on the shoulders.
Once the pectoralis major muscles have been reflected laterally, the anterior surface of the pectoralis minor muscles can be observed. First, the right pec minor is highlighted. Followed by the left pec minor. These muscle groups are then dissected away from the ribcage and highlighted. The other major muscles that can be identified in the superior region of the ribcage are the left and the right subclavius, highlighted here. It should be noted that these muscles may often cause mechanical complications with pacemaker placements, and specifically lead implantations at the point of insertion into the subclavian vein. To gain access to the heart without requiring a full sternotomy, the surgeon can access the chest cavity by resecting through the chest wall via the intercostal space. This access into the thoracic cavity can then be widened using retractors to increase the separation between the ribs. Shown here is an anterolateral thoracotomy through the fifth intercostal space, which is typically chosen to gain access to the apex of the heart. To aid in visualization of the internal contents of the thorax, the ribcage was removed from this cadaver. This would not be done clinically, and instead a partial or full sternotomy would be performed. The traditional full sternotomy involves making an axial incision through the sternum, then retracting back the left and the right side of the ribcage to expose the heart. After the procedure, the ribcage is then reapproximated and wired shut using stainless steel wire. Upon exposure of the thoracic cavity, the relative orientations of the heart and lungs can be seen. Shown first is the orientation of the left lung. The relative anterior borders are outlined here. The left lung is made up of two lobes and is generally smaller than the right to accommodate the heart within the ribcage. In end-stage heart failure, when a patient's heart may become enlarged, the function of the lungs can be compromised. Next, the anterior surface boundaries of the right lung are shown. The right lung is made up of three lobes. The human heart lies posterior to the sternum and costal cartilages, and as can be observed, the heart rests on the superior surface of the diaphragm. The heart is considered to assume an oblique position within the thorax, with two-thirds of the heart typically lying left of midline. Thus, it is considered that the heart lies obliquely in the middle mediastinum. Here we outline the heart starting at the apex, running up the free wall of the right ventricle around the right and left atria, before coming back to the apex via the free wall of the left ventricle. It can be seen that in this particular case, the pericardial sac is surrounded by a significant amount of fat. The anterior surface of the heart becomes exposed by removing the pericardium. The pericardium is the fibrous tissue around the heart that is composed of two distinct but continuous layers that are separated from each other by a lubricating substance called serous, or pericardial fluid. Now the orientation of the heart within the thoracic cavity becomes clearer, and one can more easily observe that the apex is pointed inferiorly and to the left. In each section, the highlighted anatomical feature will be followed by either a video or animation describing the function or blood flow through that feature. First, we outline the two major venous vessels that enter the right atrium, starting with the superior vena cava highlighted here. This vessel returns deoxygenated blood from the head and upper body to the heart. The inferior vena cava, highlighted here, returns deoxygenated blood from the lower body to the right atrium. The relative flow of this deoxygenated blood into the right atrium is shown here. Shown here is the relative position of the right atrium, i.e. the upper portion of the right side of the heart, with the chamber being outlined. Blood flows from the right atrium to the right ventricle through the tricuspid valve as indicated here. The tricuspid valve is open during ventricular diastole to allow the ventricle to fill, and closes during ventricular systole so to prevent the reflux of blood into the atrium. This results in the flow of blood being directed into the right ventricular outflow tract towards the pulmonic valve. The right ventricle extends from the right atrium to the apex of the heart and upward toward the pulmonic valve, up to the pulmonary artery, and thus also forms a major portion of the anterior surface of the heart. The chamber is highlighted from the apex, along the diaphragmatic surface, across the base, along the tricuspid annulus, and down the ventricular septum back to the apex. The right ventricle pumps deoxygenated blood from the body to the lungs. Blood is ejected from the right ventricle and forced through the pulmonary valve and thus enters the pulmonary trunk. The pulmonary valve is therefore open during systole as blood is ejected and closed during diastole, preventing regurgitation into the right ventricle. It closes due to the afterload created by the vascular resistance within the lungs. Blood then travels through the pulmonary valve, away from the heart, in the pulmonary arteries to the lungs to be reoxygenated within the pulmonary capillaries. Oxygenated blood from the lungs then returns to the heart, typically through the four pulmonary veins, the right and left inferior and superior pulmonary veins, and thus enters the heart into the left atrium. The left atrium is located above the left ventricle and is then the means by which oxygenated blood from the lungs drains and is pumped by atrial contractions into the left ventricle. Here the heart is being reflected to the left, so to better show the left chambers. Shown in this animation, one can observe that the flow of oxygenated blood is from the left atrium to the left ventricle via the open mitral valve. As with the tricuspid valve, the mitral valve is open during ventricular diastole, allowing the ventricle to fill, and closed during ventricular systole, thus preventing mitral regurgitation. The left ventricle is commonly found located in a posterior and lateral location in the thorax. Here, the ventricle is highlighted along the diaphragmatic surface, around the apex, then up to the ventricular septum, and then finally across the base, along the mitral annulus. As blood leaves the left ventricle, it passes through the aortic valve and into the aorta, shown here. The aortic valve consists of three leaflets, the non-coronary and the right and left coronary cusps. Branching from within the sinuses created by the left and right cusps are the left and right coronary arteries, respectively. Importantly, these supply the heart itself with oxygenated blood and nutrients. To reiterate, the valve is open during systole, allowing blood to be ejected from the left ventricle into the aorta, and closed during diastole, preventing reflux from the aorta into the left ventricle. The afterload created by the systemic vasculature that is fed by the aorta creates the back pressure, keeping the aortic valve closed during diastole. This is also when the coronary blood flow is at its highest. Finally, oxygenated blood is delivered to the body through the aorta. The descending aorta, which runs posterior to the heart and feeds the body below the diaphragm, commonly lies anterior and parallel to both the trachea and the esophagus. The blood will eventually return to the heart from the body via the superior and inferior vena cava, thus completing the circulatory system. This completes the educational video displaying how the heart is situated in the body and covering the major vessels, chambers, and valves of the heart. The use of attitudinally correct nomenclature aims to educate the viewer to the relative position of the different cardiac features within the thoracic cavity. We hope this introduction helps the viewer better understand the anatomical videos and stills displayed in the Atlas of Human Cardiac Anatomy. Finally, many thanks to the patients who have donated their bodies for the education of others, and to the Bequest program at the University of Minnesota for their continued assistance.